see it misspelled all the time. That's no lie. I'm going to talk about, give you a brief introduction to the detector, why we want ton scale, why we want argon. Brief overview of the detector design. I'm going to talk about quite a bit about Deep One, which is our 7 kilogram prototype single phase liquid argon detector. Backgrounds from the radioactive argon and then nuclear recoil backgrounds. Deep and Clean is one collaboration with many projects going on. It's a Canada-US collaboration across many institutions. A quick introduction to the program in ascending order of size. At Yale, on surface, there is the MicroClean experiment, which is 4 kilograms that can run with liquid argon or liquid neon. And if you wanted one word difference between clean and deep, it's that clean has the ability to do liquid neon. And with the ultimate goal of, say, 100-ton scale liquid neon astrophysics telescope. They've measured PSD, and they've also measured neutron quenching factors with the neutron source, or nuclear recoil quenching factors. Deep One is now running at Snow Lab, and it has run at surface at Queen's. And it is 7 kilograms. It is single phase, as is MicroClean. MiniClean 360 is 360 kilograms for dark matter and prototyping neon for particle astrophysics. And it is the primary emphasis of most of the US collaborators in the short term. And then we have the opportunity through the CFI contest to start right away on a ton scale liquid argon dark matter detector. And that's what I'll spend most of my time talking about today. The basic idea of argon is that you can get tens of keV out from a recoiling argon nucleus if hit by a WIMP. Pulse shape discrimination to separate betas and gammas from your neutrons works very well above about 20 kilovolts electron equivalent, which is roughly 60 kilovolts of recoil energy. Why a ton? The fundamental point of the deep design is that volume is good and surfaces are bad. So almost every decision we've made is based on that simple, overly simple phrasing of it. A ton lets you get large enough that the bulk of your volume is far away from your surfaces. If you got much bigger than a ton with natural argon, the background rate of the radioactive argon would be too high. So you don't want to, with a natural argon experiment, go above much above a few tons. Liquid argon has many properties of all the nobles. It's scalable. The one thing it has that xenon doesn't have is a very low price tag. This is probably not the most recent. Oh, it is. Okay. So this shows that we want to reach 10 to the minus 46, which compares to where we are now. I've left off all sorts of experiments that are trying to also cover that range. If you were to take the current dark matter limit, we would see about 923 WIMPs above 20 keV at the current dark matter limit at 100 GeV. And this is what the neutrons might look like. So what is a detector design, and what are we trying to do here? What we have is about an 85 centimeter radius, so that big across, acrylic sphere filled with liquid argon. Okay. On the acrylic sphere, there's a wavelength shifting compound. And the key point here in this design is that the photomultiplier tubes here are, there's an acrylic light guide in front of them, which brings the light from the surface out to the PMT. And these green areas are filled with acrylic filler. So there's 50 centimeters of plastic between your PMT alpha ends and your liquid argon. The only thing that touches acrylic in this, or the only thing that touches argon in this central region is acrylic and wavelength shifter. Actually, the other point I want to mention here, and this is a distinction between the MiniClean design and us, is our PMTs are operated warm. Warm being, I think, about minus 30 Celsius. And that's a good thing because then you can use standard photocathodes. You don't have to use low temperature PMTs. So these pictures are from opposite angles. This hole here is for this stairwell in the SnowLab cube hall. What you're seeing here is a common deck support structure and a common gantry crane for the Deep 3600 experiment and the MiniClean experiment. So we're going to share a deck and lab in the experiment. And this place really is rather large. It's called the cube hall because after the stairwell's put in place, you can fit in a 50-foot by 50-foot by 50-foot cube. We're going to cool in the neck. So I showed here there's a long neck design, which takes you all the way up. The cooling is going to be affected in the neck. And we're going to use heat pipes charged with liquid nitrogen. And basically, you have a boiler section at the bottom. Heat is removed. You condense here. Or the heat's removed in condensation here, and your liquid flows down. The engineering drawings look like this with two helical coils. At Carleton University, they have done a test where they've put a kilowatt at the bottom of one of these things and made it work. And now they're going through a process of optimization. Okay. We want to be sensitive to a wimp per ton per year, which means effectively our background rate has to be about 0.1 per ton per year. I'm going to talk about two types of backgrounds today. I'm going to talk about electromagnetic backgrounds, pulse shape discrimination, and I will have one brief slide on isotopically improving the argon. And then I'm going to talk about the nastier backgrounds in a sense, which is the backgrounds which come with that mimic WIMPs, the neutron and alpha recoils. Deep One, where we did a lot of, where we're doing well, the pulse shape discrimination work, is 7 kilograms of liquid argon. So we have a T with glass windows. We have acrylic light guides, and you can see Baekai here, a postdoc at Queen's University, working on the assembly of the light guides, getting them ready to go. We have ETL PMTs here. The ETL PMTs are encased in a large mass of plastic in order to absorb any neutrons. And above here, we have our plumbing system. This area here is covered with, there's an acrylic liner. On the inside of the acrylic liner, we have wavelength shifting TPB. And on the outside of the acrylic liner, we wrap it now in Gore-Tex, actually in white Gore-Tex. We used to use a paint, and I'll show you in a few slides why we don't use that paint anymore. The whole thing is in a vacuum chamber, actually made of acrylic to reduce backgrounds. Pulse shape discrimination works in liquid argon very, very well. And the reason it works is that with a low linear energy density deposited, you excite preferentially a longer-lived argon excited state, which decays optically. So you get your initial burst of light on a time scale of nanoseconds, and then you have a grass falling off with a 1.5 microsecond time scale. Whereas when you have a high energy density deposited, you have you excite almost entirely the short-lived singlet state, so you have your initial spike, and then you have almost no grass. We define a simple figure of merit that we integrate the light for the first 150 nanoseconds, and compare that to the total light over 9 microseconds, and we call that f prompt, fraction of prompt light. Using an alpha source, an ambi source, which of course comes with lots of X-rays and whatnot, and neutrons, you can see that we populate two very distinct bands, and that starting in about here at about 20 kV of electron recoil, you start getting good separation of the bands. And below about that, you lose the separation of the bands. This was data taken on surface at Queen's University and recently put on the archive and submitted to PhysRefC. So the way we are going about proving our PSD is we're using tagged gamma events. And so we're using sodium-22, which positron decays, so you get back-to-back 5-11s, and we tag one of the back 5-11s in the sodium iodide. That beta decay populates an excited state that gives a 1274 line. So we have an annulus detector. This was on surface at Queen's. We had an annulus detector to affect a triple coincidence. Underground, our rates are low enough, we don't need the annulus. So all these three triggers are put into a logic, and we were able to get a very low background beta. This is our plot of number of photoelectrons in this F prompt parameter. This is our WIMP search region, and you can see that it's empty. There are two near misses. And actually, if you were to do the sums based on the accidental backgrounds, we would expect about 0.3 or 0.4 background events from accidentals on the surface here in this data set. So we stopped because we were going to start to get encounter backgrounds on surface. This is what the F prompt spectrum looks like if you just project out this region. And this, by the way, is 100 nuclear recoil events from the AMBI data. So you can see that there's very, very clear separation. On surface at Queen's, we took 17 million events, and we had a statistics limited sample showing leakage of electromagnetic events into the signal region at, well, effectively 100% acceptance, the leakage at 6 × 10⁻⁸. Okay.
So this means that the
no, it's that okay. that's actually that, no that that's triggering. We optimized the light, we optimized the event rate, and we optimized the event rate by imposing a single channel analyzer on the logic from here, so that large signals were rejected at hardware, so we wouldn't have to write them to disk.
So this is not the photo peak.
This is not the 5-11 peak. No, absolutely not. These are, this is 100 or less. The 5-11 peak was coming in at about 1400-1500 over here. We were just suppressing it in hardware because we didn't want those events for the sample. We were too high energy. Now, this is...
Why is it peaked? I don't understand, actually.
Why is it peaked?
No, because seeing that profile is suggesting.
Yeah.
I don't understand why is it.
Well,
there's an efficiency.
Yeah, there's a hardware efficiency at low energy, so you're actually ramping up. I'll show you a copy break. And then this is a sharp cutoff imposed by a single channel analyzer on the DD theory experiment. We have 6 microsecond timing shaping amplifier, which in hardware we use to impose an upper threshold on our data for these pulse shape discrimination runs. So that effectively integrates out the pulse and gives us a signal back, which is a measure of pulse integral, and if it's too large, we reject in hardware. And what you're seeing here in the turnoff is a shoulder as that turns off. This is what it looks like if you're James Bond. There's the annulus detector. There's a little plus there that which is this center of deep, which we're aiming for. And here's the back PMT, which fits into the annulus there. Now, it's very important that we get, that we understand the pulse shape discrimination and how it's going to project into the full-scale detector. Pulse shape discrimination is a function both of counting statistics, because it is in large part a dice-throwing game, and it's also a function of energy, because the the two bands start to come together. You can see the mean value of the two bands start coming together at lower energy. So you have to make assumptions about your light yield if you're going to calculate a proper model and your statistics. So if we are able to, and our Monte Carlo simulation suggests we can, obtain 6 PeV per keV in the full-scale detector. Right now we're getting 3 in deep one, and we think we understand that. If we get 6 PE per keV, and then we look between 120 and 240 photoelectrons, we can make extrapolations as to what's going to happen in the large detector. Do our analytic models make sense? We use a Hinckley function with additional noise terms. A Hinckley function statistically describes the ratio of two Gaussians. And you can see that we get a reasonable fit to the data. Here's 120 to 240 PE, and using the same noise parameters, we get a good fit to our lower energy, lower PE data. The gray band is the systematic uncertainty from uncertainty mostly in the mean single photoelectron charge. So we have a model which describes the data within systematic uncertainty. We then take our detector parameters for deep, and if we had the happy situation in which we could just count photoelectrons in the PMT without any additional electronics noise, we would obtain we would obtain 10 to the minus 10 rejection of gamma events at 90% nuclear recoil acceptance. If we were to do the worst case scenario of having our electronics noise from deep one, which is basically a full charge integral for 9 microseconds and no counting, we would get 10 to the minus 9 at 50% nuclear recoil acceptance. Reality will be somewhere in between. Remember, in deep one, we had pulses, we had light for a full 9 microseconds, and we just integrated for 9 microseconds, so there's lots of charge integration noise there. In the large detector with 250 photomultiplier tubes, we will be able to use zero suppression and get rid of a lot of that. The other way, of course, to reduce gamma backgrounds is through depleted argon. Natural argon is 1 becquerel per kilogram. A collaboration has been formed with the Princeton group to look for sources of depleted argon. It's harder than you think, because the argon is made in the atmosphere, the radioactive argon, through cosmic ray interaction, so you think we'll just go underground. The problem is you get alpha N's underground, and if there's potassium underground, you can get radioactive argon made through reactions in potassium underground. So you need to find the right source underground. Some sources have been found with depletion factors greater than about 20, which would be great for two reasons. First of all, it reduces the PSD requirement, and secondly, it makes the design of the electronics so much easier because there's less light in the detector. And it will allow us to, you know, in the happy event that we discover 1020 dark matter events, scale up a factor of 10. There's a 60-ton tank in the part of the Snow Lab water systems, and the Princeton group has a proportional counter, and engineering is going underway to put that proportional counter in the 60-ton tank, and we're going to use that to evaluate how radioactive various sources of argon are. So that's ongoing work. Okay. I said at the beginning that one of the fundamental design ideas of the Deep 3600 experiment is that surfaces are bad and volume is good. So radon has a long-lived daughter with a 22-year half-life. Effectively, what that means in an experiment is if you admit radon, you admit permanent contamination. We've done radon studies in deep one, and we're designing to avoid problems in deep three. So if you have a decay in the bulk, you have alpha and you have the nuclear recoil, and that's beautiful because your alpha is high energy and it's not an issue. That's all right. If you have a decay from the surface in which the alpha, say, goes into your layer of wavelength shifting TPB, you get very little light from that, and then you get the nuclear recoil. Extremely bad because that looks like a nuclear recoil. That looks exactly like a WIMP signal. This can happen the other way too, though, that your decay, the alpha can go into the argon, in which case then you measure lots and lots of light, and that's okay. So basically what this is telling you is half of your surface contamination is a problem and half isn't. And then you can also get small amounts of light. For instance, if you've got an alpha in here and the alpha goes to the TPP, this can be a problem too. So radon daughters sticking on surfaces is very bad. So in Deep One, we got to do some great radon experiments. Last year's data run, main data run, started on July 4th, which is day zero on this plot, and proceeded for many months. We took some data at only 1,100 volts in the PMT instead of about 1,500, 1,600. And what this means is we were able to look at very, very high energy alpha events. And what's interesting is the time profile. So initially we filled, and we had some high energy alphas which decayed away to a level of about 1 or 2. And the red is our WIMP region of interest background. On November 11th, we had what was described here on this plot by Hugh Lippincott, the grad student at Yale, who made this as an ungraceful power outage and a loss of argon. And we refilled the detector. And this turned out to be a huge benefit because all our data analysis stuff was churning along, and we immediately knew that we'd added lots of radon. And it decays away with the appropriate decay time. And that was, so we learned an awful lot about radon. One of the things we learned about radon is that, well, radon has three alpha decays in the chain that come quickly. So the radon decays, you have an alpha here, and this alpha, which come quickly, and then you're stuck with the 22-year lead, and this stuff comes slowly. So you should have three alphas come quickly, and the last of them is this polonium-214 alpha, which sits on its own at high energy. And this, by the way, this energy calibration came from known alpha quenching from the literature. This energy scale did not come from measuring the alphas. We identified the alphas based on the energy scale. So there's polonium-214 there. And if you say, OK, we can accurately count how much polonium-214 there is, and let's say for every polonium-214, there should be one polonium-218 and one radon, you see that you actually undercount by a factor of 2 the amount of radon in polonium-218. So what this is saying is you have twice as many of these measured as you do of these. However, if you look at this, there are these are slowed down by 27 minutes and 20 minutes, whereas this comes, these two come right after each other within about 3 minutes. Our hypothesis that this peak is half the size it should be is that polonium is actually sticking to our acrylic surfaces. Half the time we measure the alpha, half the time we just measure the nucleus recoiling. So only half the time do we see a nice big alpha signal. Anyway, this radon taught us a lot. And the first thing it taught us is we needed this, which is a tube filled with a high surface area carbon. There's about 10 square kilometers of surface area inside this tube. It's cool. Yes? Yes. That's the red points. However, they are harder to identify because they're on a continuum. The nice thing about the, they're in a continuum and there are lots of, uh, you can't point to a peak and say that must be polonium 214 because it's the right energy. Right? We can't do that with a nuclear recoil. So what are you asking?
It's still just the alpha being out there. So is that also the defined energy, or what's?
Right. Yes and no. The nucleus actually doesn't travel as well through surfaces. So if it's an atom or two behind the acrylic, actually that can get degraded somewhat. So you don't get a peak necessarily if you're an atom or two in behind the plastic on the surface. But it's an interesting question. Perhaps using this Bipol coincidence, we could look for perhaps using a coincidence to high energy beta, which sets 180 microseconds, we could find it. That's an interesting idea. So we added in our plumbing system for our next fill, which we did in March, 10 square kilometers of carbon surface area that was cooled with an ethanolyzed slush. And the important point about this plot here is, well, there's two of them. First of all, when we filled, we didn't get a radon burst. And secondly, these raw numbers are a factor of 10 lower. They're a factor of 10 lower because we removed a reflective paint and replaced it with the Gore-Tex. And we also had better control of radon played out during construction. So these background rates are low enough that we can get the PSD down to 10 to the minus 9 or below. And we're commissioning a new DAC for high throughput so we can take data more quickly. And also, this will be the DAC hardware we'll use on the large detector. So I'd like to talk a bit about acrylic surfaces. During construction of the detector, they will be exposed to mine air. And mine air is loaded with radon at 10 times the rate of surface air. We will have radon daughters played out on the surface. Even worse, radon will diffuse into acrylic with a diffusion length of 0.11 millimeters. So we will need to remove radon daughter contamination from the acrylic after construction in a controlled atmosphere. And that's what this is about. This is an arm with basically a sanding pad. But if you're removing a millimeter of acrylic, that's a lot of sanding. That's almost machining. That will rotate through the sphere and clean the surface. Engineering drawings have been done, and individual components can get made. And the sanding head has been tested in an automated way. So that will remove the surface contamination. Great. Then the question is, what about bulk acrylic? Is bulk acrylic sufficiently clean? The answer is likely yes, and we're working now on proving it. And this is a tough job because we need to reduce the acrylic to do it. So what we have here is an oven with quartz glass tubes. This is acrylic vapor. So you take a large chunk of acrylic. Right now, a large chunk is grams to 100 grams. It will be 10 kilograms. Vaporize the acrylic. Burn the acrylic vapors at high temperature because you don't want them released to the atmosphere. And what you're left with at the bottom is your bottoms. And that you can then concentrate up with hydrofluoric acid. And you can have the bottoms from your acrylic reduction in, say, a milliliter of hydrofluoric acid, and then you can count them. So this is what we're working on now. This, by the way, is the procedure that was done at Chalk River Labs for snow acrylic. So in a sense, we're reinventing what we or redeveloping a procedure that we have institutional memory of. So the thorium chain is easy, and the uranium chain above radon 222 is easy to count in the residue. And by easy, I mean it's painstaking but straightforward. A germanium well counter will work. Below the radon is hard because polonium is volatile. So any polonium that you build up and then evaporate out, you lose the polonium unless you somehow manage to retrap it from the vapor. Polonium is just nasty, nasty stuff. It's so difficult to work with. So we then would need to measure the lead below the radon. Well, of course, it decays slowly. And there's only a 4% gamma branch, which makes counting it even with a low background well counter difficult. You can't do NMR on it to measure the size of the signal because lead's spinless, the nucleus. So we might try ICP-MS. We're looking at a way of counting a few million atoms of lead in, say, a milliliter or a tenth of a milliliter of hydrofluoric acid. If anybody knows how to do that, please talk to me at coffee. That's going to be tough. Because there's so few atoms, I think we may need to use an atomic technique rather than a nuclear technique, some X-ray fluorescence or something, so that you know you can measure the same atom time and again. The last background I want to talk about, and I think two or three more slides, is the neutrons from the PMT glass. You get neutrons, there's often boron in PMT glass, so you get alpha N, alpha from the, actually typically from the glass at the back of the PMTs, tends to have contaminants in it. Those alphas cause alpha N reactions. You get neutrons coming in the detector. So this is a slide from a Queen's postdoc who gave it a few days ago at Moncton. But the bottom line is, preliminary, we think we have 0.1 per year neutrons in the region of interest after you do, this is raw, and this is after you do a fiducial volume cut. So in our region of interest, we think we're at the 0.1 per year level. That's not a hard and fast statement yet. But 50 centimeters of acrylic, that's why we have those light guides to get those numbers down. So in summary, what we're trying to do for deep 3600 is get the backgrounds to 0.1 event per year per ton. So the only thing that touches the argon in the central volume is acrylic and wavelength shifter. You need absolutely exquisite control of your surfaces, resurfacing under vacuum, TPP application under vacuum, and then not letting any air in it. You need excellent control of acrylic quality, and you need lots and lots of plastic to absorb the PMT alpha, and it has to be very good plastic because, of course, you need to measure lots of light. So if your acrylic absorbs away your light, that's no good. So that's, I think those are the key issues. So thanks to Perimeter for a great few days here, and DEEP is supported by NSERC and CFI in various forms.
I have a question. Do you check also if all the plastic you use cannot be a problem regarding the water in the liquid argon, as seen by other people working with liquid argon in the world?
Oh, so you're worried about water dissolved in the acrylic coming out into the liquid argon?
Yeah, and water can give also instabilities in the response of the detector.
So,
this is
first
a
answer
very
to,
important point.
No, it is.
The,
so there's a couple answers to that. First is, of course, acrylic is cold, so that slows down the fusion through the acrylic. Secondly, we do not see that in deep one. And deep one has acrylic sleeves, which are, they're wet sanded, before the surface treatment and whatnot. So there certainly is water vapor, those acrylic sleeves in deep one. And we don't see problems with water on a prime scale of, I think our longest run was 7 to 8 months.
Gore-Tex. How does it work, actually? I mean, I like Gore-Tex for other purposes, but how does it work?
What we wanted was a diffuse reflector. We didn't want specular reflection. And so we went through several very reflective white things and we put them through a radon emanation process. Basically, you put them in an acrylic.
It doesn't reflect?
Yes, just a diffuse reflector. And it's the wavelength shifter shifted you up into the optical, into the blue-green, actually. And so that is, yeah, it's just optically white and diffusely white.
And it has an extremely high reflectivity.
You're right.
It's 99% or so.
Right. And key, it does not emanate radon.
For that purpose, it's not.
For
pants,
yes.
It's expensive, right?
No, no, it's,
oh, it's a couple of square feet.
Yeah, I mean, it's a few square feet.
Okay.
And the thing also to remember is we originally used a paint made by Bicron for this purpose, but it emanated radon. And much of the difference between the old, our first generation clean chamber and the new clean chamber when we brought the backgrounds down a factor of 10 was removing that source of radon from the paint. And many materials were tested for radon emanation and for reflectivity. And Gore-Tex was the best.
Farewell. Let's thank the speaker again.